Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The burqa has come to symbolize all that's bad in the treatment of women under the repressive Taliban. It hides the face, the body, and many say the spirit of the women it cloaks. But before Americans start to feel too self-righteous, we're looking at the cultural demands put on women in our own American society. Be thin, be tan, be pretty, and do whatever you need to do, nip, tuck, or purge, to get there. But first, the FBI's search for terrorists. Since September 11th, the agency has reversed its approach to fighting terrorists. The new strategy is to bust suspected terrorists before they have a chance to act. But is using more aggressive tactics wise? Jim McGee joins us now. He's a reporter with The Washington Post. Good evening, Jim McGee.
How are you, Tom?
We're great, thanks. Jim, you had a wonderful story in the Post yesterday that quoted a lot of former very senior FBI officials expressing deep unease with the change in tactics that the FBI has made since September 11th. What's the change been, and why so much unease about it?
Well, as you know, there's a great deal of concern about being, having tactics which are effective against terrorists. And understandably, the Bush administration is looking for ways to, better protect the American people. And there's an honest, I think, genuine desire to prevent additional bombings. Mm-hmm. That has led to some changes in policies at the department, and especially with respect to the FBI. They've been announced at various press briefings with the Attorney General. What this story did really was to talk to former senior officials at the department who have a lot of experience in terrorism, and an effort on our part to go back and look at the FBI's record with respect to preventing bombings and terrorist attacks.
I want to talk about what that record was, but first, describe in broad form the changes that John Ashcroft and the FBI have made. The former senior officials you talked to called it risky, amazing, ridiculous. What's the change?
Well, I can tell you what the Attorney General has said. He has said that he wants an emphasis put on arresting and jailing what he describes as suspected terrorists on minor criminal or immigration charges. As he put it, quote, "It is difficult for a person in jail or under detention to murder innocent people or to aid or abet in terrorism." Mm-hmm. Another thing that he suggested is cutting, one of the strategies the department has used with great success in the past are long-term investigations that combine intelligence gathering with other methods such as undercover agents, mm-hmm. electronic surveillance, and so forth. There's a desire on the part of the department to cut short these investigations when agents detect the possibility of new violence. As the Attorney General put it, even though this may hinder a criminal investigation, prevention of terrorist attacks, even at the expense of a prosecution, must be our priority. So I think that gives you some sense of it.
So you're saying the strategy used to be track down terrorists and then watch them and observe them for a long time to try and gather more information. And now they're simply rounding up lots of people and busting them as quickly as they can on whatever grounds.
Yeah, I think there's a very important part of history to understand here, Tom. Back in the 60s and 70s, and even on into the very early 80s, this country had an enormous problem with domestic terrorism, mm-hmm. and also international terrorism. There were dozens of bombings each year, and there were a half a dozen or more very active domestic and international terrorist groups in this country. Beginning in 1980, 81, 82, the FBI moved to a strategy that really focused on long-term criminal investigations, these groups. Mm-hmm. In the process of doing that, they drove down the incidence of terrorism. I mean, it's been a really remarkable record. I think between 1980 and the year 2000, the FBI prevented 131 terrorist attacks. These are bombings, most of which you've never heard of because mm-hmm. they didn't happen, but mm-hmm. they would take bombs off a 747 and so forth. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is a national treasure. I think we can all understand that. They are very good at the job of counterterrorism. And I think what comes across in the interviews that we did with the senior officials is that collectively that institution has spent 30 years refining its ability to prevent terrorism. The record is remarkably good. I mean, the FBI does a very good job, by and large.
But, Jim, on the afternoon of September 11th, no one was feeling too warm and fuzzy about the FBI. You can see why John Ashcroft might have looked and said, we've got to change course. So what's the criticism that the former officials are making now about the new thrust?
Well, much of this strategy relies, Tom, on long-term investigations of terrorist groups that focus on sort of a criminal predicate, that proceed in a way, almost as if you were conducting a long-term investigation of a organized crime family.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing that these officials stressed was that it's extremely important to be able to identify all the members of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
Who might be active, and also those who support and aid and abet them. That takes time. These are very secretive organizations. And their concern, I think, the concern they express quite directly is mm-hmm. that if the policy becomes that as soon as you identify a suspected terrorist, you immediately round them up, pick them up, put them in jail,
mm-hmm.
You may miss five or six other associates, and you really haven't disrupted the plot.
So the fear is by becoming more aggressive, we might become less effective. Has the FBI or the Attorney General's office responded to your story or to these complaints publicly?
Well, I think we do have a statement that Mr. Chertoff, an assistant attorney general in the criminal division, made yesterday during some testimony he gave in Congress. And what he wanted to make it clear that the department is going to try and do both, that they will move forward with these new tactics, but not entirely abandon the traditional methods that have served the FBI so well. He says, he used a phrase, we have to be, quote, disciplined enough to recognize there is a cost involved in protracting investigations. Mr. Chertoff has a very distinguished career as a prosecutor and is no stranger to long-term and tactics. So this is undoubtedly a controversy that will continue to an approach that will continue to be refined.
Mm-hmm. And continue to be controversial, it looks like, given the level of criticism that you discovered. Jim McGee, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Tom.
Jim McGee is a reporter with The Washington Post. When the Taliban stronghold of Kabul was liberated 2 weeks ago, the world watched closely, looking for the big signs that change had come. Shorn beards, flying kites, and, for some women, the shedding of the burqa.
Only the terrorist and the Taliban forbid education to women. Only the terrorist and the Taliban threaten to pull out women's fingernails for wearing nail polish.
At the end of 5 years of Taliban rule, this woman felt confident enough to pull back her burqa.
Afghanistan's people have been brutalized. Many are starving, and many have fled. Women are not allowed to attend school.
This woman told me she was delighted to be on her way back to her job at the university after 5 years behind closed doors. The old anxieties remained, though. She didn't want to give me her name, and she was still behind the head-to-toe burqa.
Tonight we're looking at all the ways society controls women's bodies, the whole spectrum, from the Afghan burqa to the American bikini. Is there a price to uncovering the body? Do you see it? Do you feel it? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight is Joan Jacobs-Brumberg. She's professor of history in the Women's Studies Program at Cornell University and author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls. She joins us from Ithaca, New York. Good evening, Dr. Brumberg.
Hello.
Also joining us is Jacqueline Jackson. She's a women's health advocate and executive producer of the documentary The Body Project. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Jacqueline Jackson.
Hi.
And from Vermont, our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, Walk us through. You've put a very provocative op-ed piece out recently that said, let's look at the spectrum that connects the burqa and the bikini. Afghan women suffered horribly under the Taliban, but American women don't exactly live in a paradise either when it comes to the way their bodies are perceived and controlled and what that means for them. What's the point you're making there?
Well, the provocative statement was Jackie Jackson's and mine.
All right. You can both have it.
We're not equating the burqa with the bikini. We're not weighing one against the other. It's clear mm-hmm. that if we had to choose, most women would choose the bikini. But we're trying to get people to think about the cultural complexities of covering and uncovering. And what we were saying is that the bikini is not really an uncomplicated symbol of female sexual expression. I mean, if you want to use it as a counter to the bikini, you know, the burqa is a symbol to the Taliban and to Islamic fundamentalists and to all of us to the Taliban and to mm-hmm. the Islamic fundamentalists, it's a symbol of female purity and male domination.
The burqa is.
The burqa, mm-hmm. right. And they see the bikini as a symbol of the sickness and permissiveness of American society. Mm-hmm. So we were playing with those two polarities, if you will. We certainly were not saying that we would choose to cover ourselves.
Right. I think we understand that. But it's interesting, you know, on September 10th, if you had asked people, plenty of people might have said, yeah, we've got some problems with the way sexuality is being expressed in this country, with the way our children are exposed to sexuality early on, with girls and their self-image and feeling the demand to be Barbie dolls. September 11th, we're all supposed to be united. And are, but you did crack open a more complex view of this. I mean, okay, the Taliban don't have it right, but Jacqueline Jackson, do we have it right, or are we also putting some kinds of heavy demands on women in our expectations?
Well, I think there definitely are very heavy demands on women and girls, women across the lifespan reflect that pressure. And I think what we were getting at with this is it can raise some really serious public health concerns across the lifespan. It's not just a 15-year-old wanting to look like Barbie. But you've got, you know, rampant teen smoking, which later in life is going to show up very likely as osteoporosis in an older woman. And when you look at statistics in terms of health issues across the spectrum, again, it's quite a serious issue in this country.
Do you relate those somehow to women's body images and the media pumping those out?
I think there is a very large correlation. There's just beginning to be a lot more research in this area. And the way in which we, if you will, ingest image is very different from the way in which we ingest word. And we're just beginning to learn how profoundly these images do impact. And we almost like swallow them whole. And they reflect in our health, in health and mental health.
In anorexia and real public health issues, you'd say.
And not just anorexia. I think if you look at the whole disordered eating in this country, and the spectrum of that is anorexia to obesity, which is epidemic proportions. Women don't know how to eat, and eating is what our bodies need to do each day, and it leads to an incredible range of health issues. Heart disease is the biggest killer of women in this country, and that is definitely linked to obesity. So there's just all these ties, again, across the lifespan. I think it's really important to keep that in mind. It starts young and continues through life.
Jack Beatty, the Taliban stones women. Maybe we starve them. Can we be self-satisfied with the American way?
No, we can hardly be that. You know, it's so ironic. On the one hand, we have the Victoria's Secret culture permeating the media for these young women. And then on the other hand, as an interviewer today on CNN pointed out, our young women are 7 times more likely to become pregnant than French young women. And the difference isn't that one of promiscuity. The sexual experience is the same for both. The difference is access to contraceptives. So we have this libertinism in the commercial culture and this sort of blinding our eyes to the reality that children are maturing much more quickly and need much more responsible introduction to sexuality.
We're throwing off our mental burqa tonight. The Taliban doesn't have it right when it comes to women's bodies, but do we? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or join the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
Victoria's Secret introduces the Click Miracle Bra. Click once for a little pleasure, twice for a little more. Click again. Well, you get the idea. The Click Miracle Bra. It's only at Victoria's Secret.
One.
We're talking about body image in the United States. The burqas are being thrown off in Kabul. We're thinking about women's bodies and body images right here in our own culture tonight. We're joined by Joan Jacobs-Broomberg, professor of history at Cornell and author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, and by Jacqueline Jackson, a women's health advocate and executive producer of the documentary The Body Project, also by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. So, Dr. Broomberg and Jacqueline Jackson, we take the point. You're not equating the burqa and the bikini, but you're taking the opportunity to say this is complex in every culture. Let's not just throw stones at Afghanistan. Is that right?
That's right. And that the kind of culture in which we live also constrains women's bodies in some very different ways. And we're interested in exploring those and what the physical and mental health consequences are. In this culture, I've studied adolescent girls over time through their diaries from the 19th century. And it's very clear that over the course of time, girls have become increasingly self-conscious and concerned about body image and increasingly focused on good looks rather than good works.
Give us some examples from the diaries you've looked at of young women, of girls maybe, I don't know, 100 years ago and today. What's the change been?
Well, this change is encapsulated in this formula, good works versus good looks.
What do you mean by that?
How much time we have, if you really want me to read you a very short section.
I've seen one, the New Year's resolution from 1890.
Yeah.
That was a pretty interesting one, if you have it.
Yeah, I do. In 1892, it's a 16-year-old adolescent diarist in New York, and she writes that she's resolved not to talk about myself or my feelings, to think before speaking, to work seriously, to be self-restrained in conversation and actions, not to let my thoughts wander, to be dignified, interest myself more in others.
So she's talking really about her moral character, her social character.
Exactly. And in her connection to other people, much in the way that Carol Gilligan has described.
At Harvard.
Psychologist, right. But listen to this from the 1990s, a 16-year-old girl. Stuyvesant High School student, by the way. No, I'm sorry. The date is 1982.
Okay.
So one is 1892, the other is 1982. And this girl writes, "I will try to make myself better in any way I possibly can with the help of my budget and babysitting money. I will lose weight, get new lenses, already got new haircut, good makeup, new clothes, and accessories."
So pick that apart for us. What do you hear there?
Well, what you hear there is this interest and emphasis on the outside of the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also on the idea that one has to buy something, purchase something to become a better person. And it's also a highly individualistic strategy. It doesn't make any connections to others.
Jacqueline Jackson, we hear the sharp difference over a century there between the focus on character and the focus on body. But what should we make of it? Is there a bad guy here or a bad gal? Or, you know, is this just a nation of liberty doing what comes naturally?
Well, I think Joan's point about the amount of money spent to buy things to make ourselves look better very much speaks to the point that this is a huge piece of our economic engine in this country also. U.S. advertising expenditures in this country in 98 were about $200 billion. And that's versus $317 billion worldwide. So we're a big part of it. And when you realize women's bodies are used, you know, to sell everything from beer to cars to khaki pants, it's a very important part of the American economy. And it keeps it's some of the major fuel there. So I think the tentacles of this are quite deep and pretty complicated.
So are you saying that somehow we're sacrificing our virgins on this Madison Avenue bonfire somehow? So we spend a lot on advertising. So what?
Well, I think that is an interesting way to put it.
I think the issue is that it starts terribly early. Our hard sell to young girls, and when we have young girls who are worrying at 8 or 9 about their dieting and about their appearance to the degree that they do today, that's an extraordinary brain drain.
What are the consequences of that focus?
Well, I think Jackie Jackson can speak to the physical ones. I'll just mention briefly some psychological ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we've got then is little girls who very early on, raised in this Victoria's Secrets culture, you've given it that name, mm-hmm. They're little
I think
girls
that's Jack Beatty's title, but we'll go with
all
it.
All right. They equate femininity with exhibitionism. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's something that we fail to understand about the Britney Spears phenomenon. I think also that these little girls learn to watch themselves in ways that, as adult women, become a source of self-esteem problems and also depression. A lot of good psychologists these days are talking about the fact that objectification is no longer something we can blame on men. That objectification by men, sexual objectification, mm-hmm. is done by men, but it's also done by women to themselves, mm-hmm. and that it's very demoralizing. So there are all kinds of psychological consequences for young girls who are the target of marketers and who are socialized through advertising and popular culture the way they are today.
Jack Beatty, can you imagine, can you see how Middle Eastern Muslims may look across the water at the images that come out of the United States around female sexuality and reject them?
Sure. I mean, they see it as decadence. A friend of mine, not facetiously, said, is there some way we can block sending Baywatch to the Muslim world because it's so offensive to their idea of women? Isn't this something, though? The woman unclothed is an offense and the woman clothed is an offense. And right in the middle of it, I do think we're talking about religion here, of course, but we're also talking about capitalism. The body is being fetishized by industry. This is part of our economy. And there's a real that the consequences on the health and happiness of young women is severe. But, you know, with $200 billion in advertising, there's so much riding on this sort of fragmenting of young women and sending them these bad signals about themselves. It's almost as if, years ago, places in Canada first got television. And before they had television, they had no violence, no problem, very few problems. They had television and suddenly they had all these social problems. And something like that is happening, I think, with these young women in this media. Surround they're being poisoned by it, and it's a business.
But Jacqueline Jackson, what makes it poisonous? I mean, at another level, these are this is the beautiful body, the result of fitness and health, celebrating human life, and even celebrating sexuality. Is that necessarily a bad thing?
It's bad in the way it's played out in the human body. And I think when you look at if we had a whole nation full of healthy people, I think, yes, there would not be a problem. But you have an epidemic of obesity in this nation. And, people aren't people are ingesting these images and they are being manifested in real unhealthy ways in the body. You talk about the teenage, you know, the young, the Britney Spears and the 8-year-olds trying to dress that way. Mm-hmm. And then look at adolescent females aged 15 to 19 have the highest rates of gonorrhea in this country.
Wow.
That you don't really realize that. I mean, these sexually charged images come out in sexual behaviors. And, you know, there's still a lot of teen childbearing on, which takes an enormous toll on our economy also in trying to raise these kids. So, it goes into very deep issues and is very complicated.
We have an enormous number of people who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to the phones for a second. We're talking about body images, somewhere between the burqa and the bikini. What's the right point? The Taliban doesn't have it right when it comes to women bodies, but do we? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Miriam is on the line. Welcome, Miriam.
Hi, Tom. I'm a student at Brandeis University, and I just did a short paper on the Quranic verses and that justify the hijab and burqa traditions and the gender issues that arise from that. And my conclusion basically was that it objectifies women because a woman's beauty belongs to her husband, and she's there. She lives for the man.
Wait a minute. Now I'm confused. If you're Britney Spears, you're objectifying women, and if you wear... Okay.
But in doing the research, I came across a lot of Muslim women, a lot of college students my age who said that they just recently put on the hijab, and they felt so much better because when they walked out, they did not feel like men were looking at them and judging them and objectifying them, and I was really attracted to that. And I don't think I mean, I'm not Muslim, and I would never wear a hijab, but that was extremely attractive today to me. And I mean, when I get dressed, like, I'm always thinking about what makes me attractive, what makes me look sexy.
Miriam, that's fascinating. The hijab is just the headscarf, is that right? Not the full burqa?
The hijab... Yes, but all the research I did, whenever they talked about the hijab, what they just talked about was wearing clothing that covered you from hands to neck to ankles, that was loose and not form-fitting and didn't show any of your body, as well as covering every single strand of hair.
So you're a young American woman, and you're, as I hear it, kind of seconding the notion that there's too much pressure on you to show off the body.
Oh, completely. I completely agree with that. And I didn't even completely realize that until I realized how attracted I was to the quotes that these women had said.
Are you taking it so far as to say that maybe the Taliban's get it right?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Not even close.
Okay.
I think that, in other words, I think we're both wrong, and I think we've both taken it to extremes, and that what we're looking at here, and I really appreciate the show, is that the Afghanistan Taliban regime and other Islamic sects that believe that, and in fact, those are not necessarily Islamic traditions. Those are traditions of the cultures pre-Islam that are used, and the Quranic verses are used to justify that. But the U.S., and the American culture in the U.S., I think, is the other extreme. And the women are objectified horribly here.
Miriam, thanks so much for calling us this evening. We're joined now by Jean Kilbourn. She's the creator of the pioneering film Killing Us Softly and author of Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel. Good evening, Jean Kilbourn.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So I hope you've heard a little bit of this conversation.
I've heard all of it. I've been listening in from the beginning. It's very interesting, and I very much admire the work of your guests.
Well, I've read it and enjoyed their work. But jump in here with us. We're wandering between burqa and bikini here. Just because the burqa is wrong doesn't necessarily make the way American women and girls' sexuality is portrayed and encouraged right. How far off do you think we are?
Well, I think we're quite far off. Although certainly, I mean, there's nothing that compares with the horrors of the Taliban, but. There's a kind of oppression that's internalized that comes from the inside out, and I think that's a lot of what we're talking about here, the ways in which women are often made, American women are made to be prisoners of our own negative self-images. You know, that I think that enormous numbers of women in America start every day with a real bout of self-loathing about their bodies, and that there, as has been brought up, there are major industries that profit from this self-loathing, such as the diet industry, the tobacco industry, and that if women felt, good about themselves, a lot of these industries would not be making nearly as much money. So I certainly agree that it's a there's an economic issue here as well, certainly.
You helped open this issue up with the film Killing Us Softly. Is Madison Avenue still killing us softly when it comes to women's bodies?
I would say so, very definitely. And that, if anything, it's, I first made Killing Us Softly in 1979, and I just remade it the third time recently this past year. And I think, if anything, in many ways, things have gotten worse. For one thing, the image of ideal beauty is worse than ever before because it's...
Worse in what sense?
It's worse because it's more impossible than ever before.
Meaning?
Meaning that computer retouching now gives us models who are inhumanly perfect. Cindy Crawford said recently, I wish I looked like Cindy Crawford. You know, she doesn't. She couldn't possibly because the ideal is now computer-generated.
So you're saying even if it's not the 100% Pixar digital-generated movie gal, even the ones that appear to be real women are actually so digitally enhanced and changed that it's impossible?
That's right. And so therefore... But at the same time, that it's an absolutely impossible ideal, and the ideal of beauty as well as the ideal of thinness is quite impossible. Young women and girls are made to feel that they should attain it, that somehow if they just bought the right products, if they were better people, if they tried hard enough, that they would be able to achieve this look. But it's absolutely impossible, and it's also, of course, a fairly shallow pursuit.
Well, Jean Kilbourn, in that case, over the last couple of months, as all of us have been focused more outwardly toward the Middle East in particular, do you feel any kind of sympathy or understanding for Muslim attempts to portray a greater modesty in women, or do you even buy that that's what it's all about?
I don't really think that's what it's all about. I think that this is a continuum. I mean, that there are different ways of controlling women, basically. And certainly what was the Taliban were controlling women in one way, and women in this culture are controlled in another. And again, there's no contest about which is worse. However, it is important, I think, to recognize that there is a kind of control that's going on in this culture as well, and that it has, and it does have tremendous effect on women's health, and that it is, I really agree with Jacqueline here, that it, these are public health issues, and they really need to be addressed as public health issues.
Joan Jacobs-Broomberg, do you see this as about control fundamentally, whether it's burqa or bikini?
Oh, absolutely. Although, you know, I'm not going to, you know, push the argument that... let me just say that I think there is an element of self-expression for young women in wearing bikinis, but it's not all about self-expression.
Yeah, we don't take the bikini too literally here.
I mean, it seems to me that what we're dealing with young people in particular is a lot of imitative behavior, a lot of mimetic behavior. And what's so striking to me in our polyglot, heterogeneous country, where there are so many of us who are unlean, untall, and unblonde constitutionally because of who we are by our genetics. When you look at what adolescent girls want to be, you know, all the white girls want to be 5'7" and weigh about 118 pounds. They're very specific about what it is that they want to achieve.
Not all bodies are headed toward that destination.
That's right. That's right. So, I mean, you know, we're set up for failure by our biology. And then increasingly there's a vocabulary in this country that has sold us a kind of bill of goods that if we diet or if we are successful or privileged enough to purchase some plastic surgery for ourselves, that this is the way to self-realization.
Jean Kilbourn, we've just got 30 seconds before the break, but is there an American burqa? Is there a solution that's not the Taliban style?
Is there a solution to this?
I mean, yes.
Of course, talking about it is the beginning, and to become conscious of it, and to become conscious of the fact that this is an image that, again, is unachievable and it's unhealthy.
We're trying to get to the other side of it tonight. Jean Kilbourn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jean Kilbourn is creator of the pioneering film Killing Us Softly and author most recently of Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel. We are looking at the way we think and feel about women's bodies tonight. We're using Taliban's burqa as a kind of a goad to think about how Americans... This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the role society and culture play in women's body image tonight. Let's take a minute and listen to a classic commercial from half a century ago.
Barbie, you're beautiful. You make me feel my Barbie.
Barbie's doll is really real. Barbie's small and so petite. Her clothes and figure look so neat. Her dancing outfit rings a bell. At party she will cast a spell. Purses, hats, and gloves below. And all the gadgets gals adore.
Barbie dressed for swimming fun is only $3. Her lovely fashions range from $1 to $5. Look for Barbie wherever dolls are sold.
Someday I'm gonna be exactly like you. Till then I know just what I'll do. Barbie, beautiful Barbie. I'll make believe that I am you.
You can tell it's Mattel. Well,
you can tell it's a Barbie commercial. Barbie is small and so petite. But are you? Are we? Should we ask American women to fill that model? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking tonight with Joan Jacobs-Broomberg. She's a professor of history at Cornell University and author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, and Jacqueline Jackson, a women's health advocate and executive producer of the documentary The Body Project. How about that old Barbie commercial, Jacqueline Jackson? That just is a mind blower.
Brought back some memories, I must say.
Wow.
I wanted that Barbie.
Someday I'll look just like you, but except you won't.
I don't think so.
The problem with that is that it's still, even if we try to avoid Barbie, we can't. I had an interesting experience. I'm a grandmother, and I took my two granddaughters to a family department store that shall remain nameless a year or so ago to buy some clothing to start school. Mm-hmm. And we went into the underwear department, and there they were. They had brassieres for little girls that created cleavage.
Isn't that great? Wow. Listeners, is thong America a culture of liberation or of exploitation? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Sarah is on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Tom. I am enjoying your program. I am wondering if the guests can talk a little bit about what we need to do to get past all this. And I had some thoughts. I had gone to an all-girls elementary school and felt that I was always taken very seriously for my mind, for my spirit, for my soul. And I have to say, once I went to a co-educational high school, the picture changed completely. The girls there were all concerned about getting dressed to impress the boys, and the dynamic was completely different. And I'm certainly not advocating a throwback to schools that are segregated between men and women in the old sense, but I'm wondering if there is something that we've somehow lost in having gone to complete co-educational facilities.
Well, as a professor at a co-educational university, mm-hmm. I must say that I have to agree with you.
What exactly do you agree with, Joan?
Well, I agree with the with you in the sense that the studies show that our young women, in many cases, do best and are most successful when they are in a single-sex environment at a critical stage in their adolescent life. Now, this doesn't mean that I don't believe in co-education. I do. I think what we need to do at a very early age is cultivate the idea that what's really important is what your body can do rather than what it looks like. And I think we all, as women, need to stop reading each other's bodies and the bodies of our daughters and the bodies of our sisters and friends. And every time we see each other, instead of that reflexive, oh, you look great, or you got a new haircut, or for a little girl, you look so cute. We raise our voices as though we're talking to puppies. And instead, you know, begin with or lead with, what did you do at school today? Or how are you doing in riding your bike? Have you dropped the training wheels yet?
Joan Jacobs-Broomberg, that sounds so great, that kind of grassroots movement, and yet here's where you get into the real American reality. Just look at any magazine stand, any drugstore checkout counter. Someone's buying all those magazines that are absolutely the other way, flesh and sex.
What I just said is obviously not the answer. Mm. And I think we need to get into public health campaigns to
Jackie Jackson can talk about that, and that's why somebody like me writes the kind of books that I've written, or why Jean Kilbourne is making the films that she has made.
Sarah, thanks so much for your call. Here's the question. Do you ever watch the Victoria's Secret ads and feel like an angry mullah? Let us know. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Shabnam is on the line. Welcome, Shabnam.
I had a couple of comments. The first one is that for some reason it seems it's always portrayed as only the Islamic religion which advocates women covering themselves.
Fair enough.
But Orthodox Jewish women do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And secondly,
Shabnam, are you Muslim?
Yes.
We beg your pardon on that, but it is of course a time when we're very focused on Islam lately.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Right, no, but I just thought that I'd just point that out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And secondly, also, I didn't grow up here, but I grew up in one of the Islamic countries, and I went to school totally segregated up to university level. And it was interesting that one of your guests was saying that how women perform better in a segregated atmosphere.
Did you find that a comfortable atmosphere?
I found that I must say that when I was at high school, up to high school, it was I was very good academically and I did very well. But the moment I went into university, where there were men, and I started having all these doubts about myself, and I got quite distracted from academics, which was a bad thing. And then when I came here to the United States years ago, I made a lot of American friends, and I was amazed by how very successful women, career-wise, financially independent, but they were all the time obsessed with the bodies, with the dieting. They'd weigh themselves every morning. I mean, sometimes for a while I was a roommate with one of my close friends, and she would weigh herself all the time. She would always want to be like a size 2. I'm a size 2, and she thought that was wonderful.
Shabnam, what was your home country?
It was Pakistan.
And did you find women in Pakistan less obsessed with their bodies?
Totally, because you see, we'd never had to. It was a totally new experience for me here, because there, even though we don't necessarily wear the burqa all the time, like in Afghanistan, but we do dress very modestly, and also we grew up in a single sex, going to school single sex, and so the pressures are not there. And also, when we get married, it's arranged marriage usually.
So you're not fishing with your body for that mate.
No, we're not fishing with our bodies, exactly. So it was a completely new thing. When I came here and I saw how American women, the pressures on them are enormous, I felt, and especially my roommate and close friend for a while, she's actually from a Russian Jewish background, and her build is such that she'll never ever be a size 2.
But she wants to be a size 2.
She's more natural, like a size 14.
Shabnam, thank you so much for opening our eyes and for the insights. Jackie Jackson, well, this makes it sound like maybe the solution is something that we would have thought of as medieval. Separate the sexes, send them off into different universes. That's not possible.
I don't think it is, actually. I think one of the bigger things we need to do, really, is start to get a better understanding of the ways in which pictures impact us.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall McLuhan warned back in the 60s that our culture was shifting hugely from word-based to picture-based, and that he said, we have not the art to argue with pictures. I think we still do not have that art. I think doctors, psychologists, an assessment of how many pictures you ingest each day should be a part of a standard evaluation. We've got to get a better handle. The literary people of this world are so proud of words, and yet these pictures are having a tremendous influence.
You're saying taking people's minds, their psyches, out of reality and into a media, an image world.
The brain processes pictures very differently than words. Words are quite sequential, and the lobes of the brain actually take them in very differently than they do pictures. And it has, it impacts the body. And the AMA just a year or so ago finally linked the violent images and violent behaviors. That's one of the first times that, it is the first time a major medical group says that they need to do that with these body images. They're everywhere. They're on every newsstand.
It's a fascinating
thought. We need to understand.
That simply living in a media society could really change our relationship with our own self-image. Jackie and Joan, stand by. We've got a lot of callers. I want to try and get a couple more in. John is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hello, John.
Yeah, hi. I've been listening to what's been discussed as far. I wanted to make a reference, first of all, about four callers back. You had a girl, she said she was a student. She had been doing some research on...
on the burqa, yes.
Exactly. Yeah, and now she made an interesting point, and she made a reference to the fact that she personally became attracted by the ideal. I think that is something that needs to be examined to the extent that we look down on it because we don't see any choice there. We see the women as being, forced into this. It's something that they have to do.
The burqa, yes.
Exactly. It's not something they can decide to wear a burqa or a bikini, as you referenced so many times. It's, if you look at it, the reason we look down on it is because there's no choice. Mm-hmm. Now, if it was a society that, sold Victoria's Secret on every aisle, but then the women chose to wear these things, I don't think that we would look down on it.
So what are you suggesting, John?
I'm suggesting that we're examining this with too much scrutiny based upon, the lack of choice. I think we're looking down upon it too hard because I think that presented with a choice, I think that a great deal, if not most women, would in fact choose to go with such methods. I mean, I believe that they would choose to go this way because...
I got it, John. We're running out of time, and I want to thank you for that call. Jackie Jackson, quickly, do you see American women adopting a nipped and tucked burqa of some kind?
No.
but John's saying, that there ought to be some path open to modesty here that doesn't seem obvious right now.
I think the path needs to be just not so much obsession with the body and let women be and dress as they wish. I mean, we want to look like what our culture expects of us, and we learn more from all the pictures of what they think we should look like, and we want to be part of the group. I mean, that's an overwhelming human desire to be part of it. So I think we need the choice and maybe go back to, as Dr. Brumbrook said, we're a little more emphasis on good works and moral our character rather than what our bodies look like.
Joan Jacobs Brumberg, final thought. In your students at Cornell, do you see that migration back to good works as the goal?
Well, Cornell is a university that's filled with a lot of wonderful students who are committed to their community and to improving human social life around the world. But I still also see within that student community, and I've spoken at colleges and universities all over the country, an enormous amount of what I would call bad body fever. Women who, as Jean Kilbourne said, wake up in the morning loathing themselves. And from a historical perspective, and I am a historian, I think that, one of the things that's so interesting is that we can actually nab when this began historically. And it begins back in the 1920s, really, a critical time period when visual images and film and advertising all come together in a kind of modern constellation. And that's when dieting among girls is born.
Joan Jacobs-Rubenberg, we're going to come back to it on another night. It's a fascinating, fascinating subject, and we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Joan Jacobs-Brumberg is author of The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, and Jacqueline Jackson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Jackson is executive producer of the documentary The Body Project. We were joined earlier by Jean Kilbourne, whose latest book is Can't Buy My Love, How Advertising Changes the Way We Think and Feel. Jack Beatty, has our conversation tonight changed the way you think and feel?
Well, it's made me more empathic with the dilemma of American young women today, torn between their wish for stable relationships and happiness and the pathway the culture says they can get it by being attractive. A lot of this, has to do with men, too. I mean, it's not just young women. The men have got to change. And there's a new movie out, Shallow Hal, about a man who comes to a sort of frisson when he recognizes that the appearance of the woman is not nearly so important as what's inside. What did Martin Luther King say? We should be judged not by the color of our skin, not by what's outside, but by the content of our characters. And I think we need some of that for our young ladies.
And how fascinating that Afghanistan's Taliban might lead us to talk about it tonight.
Yeah.
It is a small world.